I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, an update on the Maryland General Assembly. Late last week, a bill that would require many Maryland employers to provide paid sick leave advanced out of committee. There's also legislation to make Maryland a sanctuary state and to legalize marijuana. And Maryland Attorney General Brian Frosch now has the authority to bypass Governor Hogan to challenge the Trump administration in court. The spokesman for the governor says that this is one of as many as 100 bills since he was elected aimed at limiting Governor Hogan's power. At the halfway mark in the session, a reporter's notebook on the General Assembly with WIPR's Rachel Bay, Aaron Cox of the Baltimore Sun, and Len Lazarick of MarylandReporter.com. That's coming up on Midday, right after the news. And good afternoon, everybody. Glad you're with us. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday here on 88.1 WIPR. This year's session of the Maryland General Assembly is a little more than halfway to the finish line. Lawmakers from around the state convened 48 days ago. There are 43 days left before sine die, or sine die, as folks call it, on April 10th. With budget woes that could dramatically affect schools in Baltimore and throughout the state, as well as many other programs, it appears that power is not unexpectedly also on the daily docket in Annapolis. Governor Larry Hogan has cited 30 bills that he says will attenuate his control and pass more authority to the House of Delegates and the Senate. A close aide puts that number at about 100 since the governor was elected in 2014. Case in point, lawmakers okayed a measure that allows Maryland Attorney General Brian Frosch to sue the Trump administration without the permission of the governor. Bills about Maryland being designated a sanctuary state, requirements for employers to offer paid sick leave, measures to legalize marijuana, and bills that would impact how prescription drugs are regulated are also on the minds of lawmakers. These are all things that are also front of mind for our panel today. Three reporters who cover the legislature join me here in Studio A. Aaron Cox is the State House Bureau Chief of the Baltimore Sun. Rachel Bay is the Annapolis reporter for WIPR. And Len Lazarick is the editor and publisher of MarylandReporter.com. Welcome to you all. Good to see you. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday.
Good to be here.
So an accountant from PricewaterhouseCooper has handed me an envelope with our first with our first topic, and it is moonlight. Oh, no, I'm sorry. It's not moonlight. It's paid sick leave. Yes, moonlight is a mistake. It was right last night. It's wrong this morning. Our first topic, paid sick leave. So, Aaron Cox, it looks like this is a bill that is winding its way. It's out of committee, and they're going to take it up tonight. It did actually make it this far last year. What are its chances this year?
Much improved over last year. It made it close to the finish line last year. This year, it's already almost, I guess if we're going to continue this metaphor, lapped itself. So it's out of committee. It's on the floor of the House of Delegates. It's largely the same bill that the same chamber passed a year before. It would give mandatory paid sick leave to employees who work at companies that have at least 15 employees or more. For people who work at smaller companies, they would be required to have unpaid sick leave. Something in the same construction is expected to come out of a Senate committee, I believe, sometime today. So it is advancing faster than it did last year. And if it gets out of a Senate committee, further than it did last year.
Mm-hmm. So Len Lazarick, the governor has a suggestion about paid sick leave as well, but it differs somewhat significantly from the bill that they're going to be considering tonight.
It differs in terms of the number of people that are covered. The House bill covers everybody, every employer with 15 or more employees. The governor wants to cap it at 50 and then throw in some tax incentives for smaller employers.
The difference then is 15 as opposed to 50. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It covers the House bill as coming to the floor covers several hundred thousand more people. And there are also additional requirements about how they calculate it. It was never likely that the governor's bill was going to pass because the House had already the House had passed this version last year, and it got hung up a bit in the Senate. But it allows the governor to say, if they do finally pass it, and he has to make up his mind whether he's going to veto it or not, he can say, well, I had a proposal that, you know, that I really liked, but they didn't pass it, so I'm going to send it back to them. Whether that scenario happens or he lets it become law or it gets hung up again, you know, we can never really predict what's going to happen because things happen. You know, yeah. bills get hung up for various reasons.
Aaron, what do you think?
Well, I think it shows that the governor is an astute politician, right? So he's put himself in a position where he's for an issue before he was against it. If he has a proposal for sick leave, he's a guy who's for sick leave. He can put that on his campaign literature. He can tell his supporters that he was the guy that came up with a measured compromise. And so whether or not that he ultimately signs whatever comes out of the General Assembly, he's positioned himself to be for this concept.
Yeah, and so he's sort of muting the attack ad before it's written. Yeah.
And the poll that we're going to discuss later, again, affirms what we've seen before. Paid sick leave is very popular among all demographic groups, including including Republicans.
Yeah, but so, Rachel Bay, it's not very popular among some employers, right? I guess, I mean, there are people complaining that this would be a job killer, that it would be too expensive, that it's a mandate that's just not doable for certain businesses.
I mean, yes and no. There are employers on both sides of this. You will find businesses who say this is a good employment practice to have my employees not be worried about taking care of their sick kids when they're at work, or staying home, coming to work sick and being less productive. But you will also find employers who say this is a burden on me. This is an additional cost that I have to pay my employees not to come to work. And so that is kind of where the argument breaks down. I will say that on the poll that came out today, half of the, and we, I know we'll talk about this later, but half of the respondents were asked about the governor's version of the paid sick leave bill, and the other half were asked about the bill that would apply to employers with 15 workers. And it really didn't make a difference which one they were asked about. Both people who responded to the poll said that they supported both proposals rather equally.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, it could affect as many as 700,000 people in the state of Maryland. For what it's worth, Lena Wen, who's the health commissioner of Baltimore City, was on the show last week, and she certainly is a supporter of it as a public health issue, because you got folks, and most of the folks affected by a bill like this are at the lower end of the wage spectrum, and they just feel like they can't afford to take a day off. So they're showing up to fast food restaurants and to various other places with contagious diseases. And, you know, there have been some major chains. I mean, Chipotle most recently and dramatically, you know, who've really had a problem with people coming to work when they really shouldn't have because they were too ill to be there.
A little while ago, I talked to someone who did a study of the effect on paid sick leave bills in other cities around the country. And he said that there's actually been found that these paid leave proposals actually decrease the amount of the infectious disease rate. So in other words, cities that have these proposals have seen a decline in the rate of people who present with the common cold. Of course, there are people who argue that those studies have their flaws, so it's hard to know for sure, but there certainly are those arguments out there.
Mm-hmm. So there have been, I guess, a couple of hearings on the governor's bill. The bill that they're going to talk about tonight is called the Maryland Healthy Working Families Act, and the governor has proposed a different, you know, as you say, a different version. So I guess, Aaron, there have been some hearings, but it's gone nowhere, right? I mean, it's not that they've never thought about it.
Well, no, I mean, they listened politely. And Chairman Mac Middleton, who's the influential state senator in this story, he sits on the Finance Committee. He is the one pushing forward sick leave in the Senate. I mean, he had complimentary things to say about some of the governor's proposals, that he thought that, you know, it was a nice idea to offer small businesses some sort of a tax incentive in order to offset the expense of this benefit. On the other hand, and this doesn't get talked a lot about a lot, but the governor's proposal to offer offer those incentives has a price tag of about $60 million a year, which, you know, that's what it costs to build two elementary schools, or that's, you know, that could fill the budget hole in the city of Baltimore. I mean, it's a large budget, but $60 million a year is a significant sum of money. So from the perspective of the advocates of this proposal, they say that the governor's plan doesn't cover as many people and it costs a lot more. And so while they appreciate the effort, they're going to go ahead and stick with their plan.
Mm-hmm. And he calls his bill, by the way, the Common Sense Pay Leave Act, as opposed to the Maryland Healthy Working Families Act. Len Lazar, Aaron mentioned the astuteness of Mr. Hogan's political instincts. A new poll out today from the folks up at Goucher College. Malia Cromer was on Sheila's show this morning on the record talking about this. And you guys have weighed in on it as well. 63% of folks in the state support the governor. That's a very high approval rating. It's a little bit down from 70% in September. Should we read anything into the fact that it's 7 points lower than it was 5 months ago?
Well, Malia says no, and it corresponds to where he was during session. So apparently the popularity goes down. Malia also I don't know whether it makes a lot of difference, but the Goucher folks don't just do registered voters. There's at least about 100 not registered voters, and so it's a slightly different sample. But the popularity thing, the other element of the poll is it did ask the voter contingent of the poll whether they would support the governor's reelection, and it was, I believe the figure is 57% said that they were likely to support him or leaning that way, but we're still a long way out. I mean, is it significant? Do the Democrats pay any attention to his poll numbers other than wanting to drive them down? That's hard to say. So,
I would say, based on the number of emails and text messages I've gotten from Democrats this morning, they certainly do pay close attention to the governor's poll numbers. And you know, his high popularity is something that people have thought make him a very formidable candidate, even though he's a Republican in a state where Democrats outnumber Republicans 2-1. You know, coming into the session, the guy had a 70% approval rating. That's among like the highest in the country among governors of any state, let alone governors of a state who are not from the party that represents the majority they govern, right? And so, Malia Cromer, who did the poll, said, she thinks this is cyclical, and it's her poll to comment. I just a couple of other things to consider I wanted to point out there, that they've been doing this poll since Hogan took office in January 2015. This is the first time his numbers have gone down at all. I mean, granted, what goes up must come down. They were pretty stratospheric in the first place. But to the point of what to make from a 7-point drop, I think it depends on who you are. I mean, if you're Larry Hogan supporters, you think that's really, it's really good he's doing so well this far into his term. If you're Democrats hoping to unseat him, you're seeing the first glimmer of hope that you've really had in a while.
Yeah, and Rachel Bay, does the specter or the fact of Hogan's incredible popularity sort of hover over all things going on, all discussions going on in Annapolis? I mean, when you compare that with Donald Trump, who's polling at 29% here in Maryland, the U.S. Congress is polling evidently at about 21%. Mr. Trump himself nationally polling at less than 50%. He's like 44-45%, according to the Wall Street Journal and NBC News. So as Aaron mentioned, Hogan's number is way better than that. Is this something that sort of in some way informs every conversation everybody's having down there?
As Aaron said, it depends on who you are. I mean, so Hogan and Hogan's staff will frequently point to his popularity and how in sync he seems to be with public opinion on several issues when they're talking about his policy issues. For example, the poll asks, for 3 years, it has asked about public opinion on transportation policy. And this is something Malia Cromer from Goucher pointed out to me was that there's been a trend over the last 3 years that 3 years ago when they asked people, do they think the state should spend more attention, pay more attention and spend more money on improving roads and highways or improving public transportation, the percentage of people who said roads and highways was about 50% 3 years ago. And gradually over the last 3 years, it has increased to 59%, which, by the way, happens to also align with Governor Hogan's position on the issue, which is that the state should be spending more energy, more funding on roads and highway improvement. And so the question, I mean, we don't know whether this is a result of Hogan's message resonating more with voters and with people who are responding to the poll, or if there's some other factor at play here. Could be the woes of the Washington Metro Rail are affecting people who live in that area. Who knows?
Yeah, Malia's even said, I mean, she told Sheila Cass this morning that, you know, it could be just as simple as people who live near places where the public transit is available and easy to get to are for it, and people who don't are against it. I mean, they would rather have roads. So, I mean, it could be something as simple as that. But polls, you know, we love them polls, don't we?
But the problematic, one of the numbers that's, I think, problematic for the future for Hogan is the two questions about education. Well, actually, it wasn't a question. It was a question about what's your top priority? And 18% of the people, the highest priority was education. And two-thirds of the people in a later question said that the state should spend more money on education. Now, the governor has been funding education, but there's currently a commission going on that's going to change the funding formulas, going to recommend changes in December. And that could be a place where the governor has some problems if they recommend, as their consultants have told them, to significantly increase funding and you have two-thirds of the people. I mean, a lot of the stuff that he does is popular with people, and that's the reason for the paid sick leave proposal.
All right, plenty to talk about when we come back from a break. Rachel Bay is the Annapolis reporter for WYPR. Aaron Cox is the State House Bureau Chief of the Baltimore Sun. Len Lazarick is the editor and publisher of MarylandReporter.com. We'll have lots more on the goings-on in the Maryland legislature when we come back from this quick break. If you want to join our conversation, 410-662-8780 is our phone number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the broadcast, we'll take a look at a proposal to create safe spaces for drug addicts so that they can use drugs. The idea is that if people are going to inject narcotics, it's better to have them do it in a safe, sterile environment where they can also access other services to help them kick their habit. There are folks in Europe and Canada who think this is a very good idea, and there are some researchers at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health who agree. We'll talk to one of them, as well as a person who treats addiction, on Midday Tuesday. If you've just joined us today, we're getting an update on what's happened so far and what's expected to happen in this year's session of the Maryland General Assembly. Aaron Cox is the State House Bureau Chief at the Baltimore Sun. Rachel Bay covers Annapolis for WYPR, and Len Lazarick is the editor and publisher of MarylandReporter.com. They are with me here today in Studio A. You are as welcome to join us as they are. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So let's talk, Rachel, a bit about these bills that the governor has cited that are simply intended to diminish his power. He threw out the number of 30. Doug Mayer, who's a spokesman for the governor, says that number doesn't take into account all of the bills that have been introduced, not just in this session, but in the other sessions while the governor's been in office. And he said their guesstimate is that it's somewhere around 100. The governor is feeling somewhat you know, somewhat put upon by the legislature trying to grab a little power here, a little power there. What's going on?
I wouldn't get too hung up on the exact number of bills. I think the general idea is this message that he's putting out, this theme he's putting out, that the Democrats in the General Assembly are trying to pull power away from the governor's office, power that, by the way, is not Hogan's necessarily, but the institution of the governor's office. And it's really becoming an us versus them conversation. At the top of the list this year is the bill that has now become law that allows the attorney general to bring lawsuits against the federal government without getting a case-by-case permission from the governor's office or the General Assembly, which is the established rule before. And so that's kind of the top of the list. But there are a number of other bills that a lot of them dealing with things like who gets to appoint people to various boards and commissions, local school boards, board of licensing commissioners, et cetera. And these are the governor takes issue with the idea that particular right of his, the ability to appoint people to various boards and commission, is being infringed upon.
And of course, most folks point to the fact that this year, the third year of the governor's term, this is the governor's third session, is the year traditionally with other governors, Len, that they make the most progress, because it's not the election year. Next year, 2018. He will be putatively running for office again, and there will be several people running against him in the Democratic primary and then in a general election. So you wrote about the fact that this bill to give the attorney general the power to do this got through fairly quickly. I mean, this was like a 48-hour deal. It was like a two-day thing that between testimony and people who had the, you know, who supported the bill. They didn't hear from opponents. The Republicans in the Senate took umbrage at that, didn't they?
It was a real rush job, and in retrospect, it was completely unnecessary. And the way that Miller pushed it through and didn't give them what was at the point in the session was a fairly standard courtesy of just give us a day to make amendments, and yeah, we'll propose amendments, and they'll all fail. And so, you know, 2 weeks out, we can see Attorney General Frosch hasn't used the power yet. He says he doesn't have any plans to use the power yet, and yet they rushed it through. I think you can make the kind of academic argument that constitutionally that perhaps the powers of the Maryland governor, who is considered one of the strongest in the country, ought to be diminished, and the Democrats are simply taking advantage of the fact that there's a Republican governor to do this in order to restore some balance. And the argument about the attorney general's power was 41 attorney generals have this power anyway. But so there are actually good, reasonable arguments for them to do what they did. But the reason they did what they did was political and related to a Republican governor and the new Republican president.
And Aaron, the actual impact of this, I mean, Brian Frosch, the current attorney general, did talk to the governor about legal action challenging the constitutionality of President Trump's travel ban. Where does that stand?
To my knowledge, they are not continuing to discuss it. The governor, just to be clear, so what the legislature did was give blanket authority to the attorney general to bypass the governor in suing the Trump administration, and that they announced their intention to do this on the same day that Frosch asked the governor for permission to do it. So they had this kind of parallel track going. And then 9 or 10 days later, in the way that Len just described, they pushed this through in 48 hours. I would argue that it was necessary if you were interested in portraying yourself as the Democrats in Maryland who are standing up to Trump, right? Like, it was necessary to do it quickly and decisively if that was your goal. But I mean, Brian Frosch told lawmakers in the House Rules Committee as they were debating this that he didn't have any immediate plans to sue the lawmakers. So, to sue the Trump administration. So at the same time that they were pushing for this through the legislature, Brian Frosch asked for the governor for permission. The governor responded to ask for more documents about why he wanted to do it. Frosch responded with a bunch of documents. And then before they had finished going through the governor's staff had finished going through them, the attorney general joined an amicus brief, at which point the governor's staff said, well, I guess he's just going to do what he's going to do without us.
Now, the attorney general may not have any immediate plans to do anything in court against the Trump administration, although he has asked for $1 million a year to hire 5 lawyers. I mean, Len, I think you wrote about this. I mean,
yes.
So he may not have any particular plans, but he wants $1 million. I mean, so for fiscal hawks, they may look at that and say, look, this is $1 million for phantom lawyers we don't need at the moment.
Right. The day that it passed. Well, there would be a period of 18 months where he didn't have this $1 million. That bill, and it is actually a bill that is a mandate to give the attorney general 5 staff. And one of the ironies of this is they were asked, well, where did you come up with this $1 million? And Frosch and Delegate Sandy Rosenberg said, well, we used as a model this Scott Pruitt in Oklahoma, who just became
the head of the EPA,
who had sued the EPA for 14 times, and he had created his own federalism unit in order to sue Obama. So they used the model of the guy that was suing Obama all the time on his executive orders to go after Trump.
410-662-8780 is our number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Rachel, this is an example of a state legislature, and there are very few of them controlled by Democrats around the country, trying to act quickly and decisively in the wake of these executive orders that are, you know, coming out of the White House at the speed of light. I mean, they're basically saying we need to protect Marylanders from the president of the United States. How's that playing with most of the folks in the legislature? Is this one of these things that was, you know, the vote was a party line vote? What do you think? What will that matter, or how will that inform? Will it matter, this kind of measure, when it comes to other things that they've got to be talking about for the rest of the session?
I mean, it's definitely become a theme that the Democrats are pushing. This change was introduced as part of a press conference announcing several different initiatives that the Democrats are taking to try to target the Trump administration and to try to fight Trump administration policies. It's definitely a message that's being pushed. And, you know, how that actually ends up playing out from one piece of legislation to another kind of varies. So you do see it on, for example, immigration issues, and on trying to there are measures in the General Assembly targeting the executive orders and actions that the Trump administration has taken with regard to sanctuary cities and with regard to enforcement of federal immigration laws. There are also measures being heard about how the state responds to changes to federal healthcare law. There's a number of these different measures and they're kind of, you know, going through the legislative process in a slightly slower fashion than that attorney general change got made. And so we'll see how they kind of play out over the course of the next 45 days.
Yeah, 43, I think.
43,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
But who's counting, right? Well, yeah.
I was just going to say there's a couple of along the lines of what Rachel was talking about, that there's a couple of different layers here, right? That that Maryland legislators are using their platform as state lawmakers to protest Trump policies and to what extent that's necessary, right? That these are actions that have to be taken to protect people is a different question than to what extent that's what their constituents want to hear them doing, right? That they are expressing the views of the people who elected them and using the platform that they have to speak out against the Trump administration. And, you know, whether it colors the debate or the policies that they pass in Maryland, I think that may not actually play out that way, that what's happening here is more that lawmakers are using the microphone they have to say things to their base.
Aaron Cox is the State House Bureau Chief for the Baltimore Sun. Len Lazarek is with MarylandReporter.com, and Rachel Bay covers the State House for us here at WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @Midday. Tom Hall. Let's go to the phones. Angie in Ellicott City, welcome to Midday with our crack panel of terrific journalists who pay very close attention to the Maryland Assembly. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thanks, and I'm glad they pay close attention because there's a bill that a lot of us in Howard County are really interested in and want to know what kind of a chance it has. We were really shocked a few months ago when we discovered that local boards of education in Maryland, unlike any other state, can hire their superintendent but not fire them. And a lot of us want to fire our local superintendent. So there is state legislation pending that would let all of the county boards fire their superintendents for cause, of course. And I was wondering what the chances are that that will pass.
Interesting. I wasn't aware of that one. That's a new one to me.
Well,
Len, what do you think?
I regret to say that my wife asked me about this yesterday. I live in Columbia, so I'm a Howard County resident, and I followed the school board thing closely. I think the boards can fire superintendents for cause, but they need to get permission of either the state superintendent or the state board. What happened in Howard County is the people that renewed the superintendent's contract were all defeated in the last election, so there's a new majority on the board that doesn't very much like the superintendent, and she has preemptively filed suit against her board. So it's a very contentious situation out there. The prospects for the bill, if it's a statewide bill, then you know, my immediate speculation would be it's a bit problematic, but I haven't read the bill. I don't know what it says. And if somebody else on the panel knows anything about it.
Yeah. And as far as we know, there's no other jurisdiction that has a similar problem, where the local school board's hands are tied when it comes to their superintendent.
Well, and the situation differs county by county. In Prince George's County, the county executive now has a authority and just chose to renew the contract for the superintendent. And I think Mayor Pugh would like to have the authority.
Yeah, she would certainly like to have more input on the school board, people that she's appointed.
Yeah, everybody's always wanting more authority for themselves.
Yeah. Well, Angie, thank you for your call. I'm sorry we weren't able to give you a 100% complete answer, but we will keep an eye on that situation in Howard County. It does sound pretty contentious. 410-662-8780 is our number, our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall, our email, midday@wipr.org. Let's talk a little bit, Aaron, about in light of the fact that we've discussed how Governor Hogan's popularity is still quite significant and substantial. The Democrats evidently have hired some sort of consulting firm or a strategist to keep an eye on the governor. And is this obviously something with an eye on the election coming up next year?
Right. So they brought on a full-time strategist, which they openly advertised as being hired to hold the governor accountable. That's the phrase that they use. And what this person has been doing is kind of pointing out to the media and to the public and anybody who listen what the Democrats see as inconsistencies in what Governor Hogan says, what he says versus in the past. And basically, it has the effect of starting a campaign early without necessarily having a campaign opponent, right? Democrats don't have a single candidate or anybody, I believe, that said they definitely intend to run, who have launched a campaign, so that they can start kind of kind of bringing down those high approval ratings a little bit early.
So it's the perpetual campaign issue. Here we are. We're it's like Oppo research before there's even an actual campaign. All right, more to talk about when we come back. Len Lazar is the editor and publisher of MarylandReporter.com. Rachel Bay covers Annapolis for WIPR. Aaron Cox is the State House Bureau Chief at the Baltimore Sun. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday. Tom Hall, you're welcome to join us after the break. Before we take that break, on Mondays here on Midday, we read the names of the people who lost their lives to violence in Baltimore during the previous week. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 51 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. 4 people were the victims of homicide in Baltimore last week. They are Antoine Mayo, age 41, Sherman Smith, age 40, Thomas Lee Jr., age 38, and Jackie Burris, who was 26 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. And welcome back. It's Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, this programming note, WIPR will bring you NPR's live coverage of President Donald Trump's address to Congress tomorrow night at 9 o'clock. And by the way, Choral Arts Classics, which was originally scheduled to air tomorrow night, will come to you Wednesday night at 9 here on WIPR. If you've just joined us today, we're getting an update on what's going on in the Maryland General Assembly with 3 reporters who pay very close attention. Aaron Cox is the State House Bureau Chief at the Baltimore Sun. Len Lazarick is the editor and publisher of MarylandReporter.com. Rachel Bay is the Annapolis reporter right here at WIPR. You are welcome to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to Lauren in Annapolis. Lauren, welcome to Midday with Aaron Cox, Len Lazarick, and Rachel Bay.
Hi. My mom was actually a participant in Goucher's survey. Someone called our house last week, so I was really happy to hear the results had come out because I thought it was cool that she was a participant in something I was hearing about on the news. But I was wondering what you guys all thought, if Hogan will publicly speak for or against any of Trump's executive orders, the likelihood of that, or if he'll continue to stay silent.
Well, thanks for the call, Lauren. I appreciate it. The governor has tread lightly when it comes to the subject of Donald Trump during the campaign, refused to endorse him, says he didn't vote for him. I guess he voted for his father. Governor Hogan is an interesting case. I mean, he did not hold elected office before he was elected in 2014, but he did work in the Ehrlich administration, and he grew up in a political household. Rachel Bay, how do you think he's doing when it comes to walking that tightrope with the initials DJT?
Well, so first, Hogan has very much intentionally refrained from really stepping into national politics of late. He hasn't taken positions on policies that Trump has enacted, and every time he's asked about it, he says that his focus is on Maryland and that he's not going to wade into federal politics. Goucher actually asked about whether people thought that his focus was too little or too much on federal politics and on the federal government, and also asked whether the General Assembly's focus is too much or too little on federal politics. The sense is that people, about a quarter of people, I believe, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but said that the General Assembly was focusing a little too much on federal politics, and that Hogan, people were generally pleased that Hogan is not wading into that fray.
Aaron Cox, this is a smart politician, any way you slice it.
Well, you know, what does he really have to gain from talking about Donald Trump's policies, right? That, you know, I mean, I will say his mantra that I am focused on Maryland is, I mean, from a reporter's perspective, it's somewhat infuriating because he refuses to answer questions and implies that somehow the question is not related to Maryland. But I mean, it has been something he said consistently throughout his tenure when asked about, you know, Donald Trump or other sorts of, you know, contentious issues. And it's served him well, right? So, I mean, 44% of people in the Goucher poll said he spends about the right amount of time talking about Donald Trump. I mean, so say he comes out against it. Like, what does that do for him? The people who already didn't support Donald Trump, I mean, he can't do anything about it. He doesn't intend to do anything about it. Say he says that he supports it. You know, that could alienate him with, you know, with the Trump White House. I mean, he has taken the tact that it is not in his benefit to say something. It's not in his purview. It's not in his influence. And so, therefore, he's going to stay kind of in this limbo where he doesn't say he's for it or against it. And, you know, kind of the political question that a lot of people have been talking about lately is how long he can continue to do that.
Mm-hmm. And Len, what about, you know, there are folks who say that on behalf of the citizens of Maryland, he's got no reason to alienate the Trump administration, which may be the
and
font
he,
of federal
he
dollars.
He makes that point explicitly at the end of the Board of Public Works, where there was a protest but that he wasn't speaking up. He made the point that, you know, I got along with Obama, even though he had criticized Obama during the campaign, which the Democrats are trying to use against him. And his point that I'm working for Maryland, so I'm trying to get the best deal with this guy. He didn't use those terms, but in essence, I'm trying to get the best deal with this guy. And it will become problematic when we actually see what the Trump administration is going to do about the Affordable Care Act, because that has the potential to do tremendous damage to Maryland's budget if there's a cutback on the Medicaid funding. But Hogan's point of view is, hey, we got 10 legislators, 9 of them are Democrats, most of whom are very critical of Trump. They're there. I'm here. Although, you know, this weekend and this morning, as a matter of fact, he's at the White House. He was at the White House last night for the dinner and
the
White House.
The Governor's Association.
And
right.
They're going to be talking about healthcare, among other things. So there may come a point where he actually does need to say something because the Trump policies are specifically affecting him. But at the moment, he just wants to get money out of Trump.
Jim in D.C., welcome to Midday with Len Lazarick, Rachel Bay, and Aaron Cox. Glad you called.
Hey, yeah, I feel like I had my thunder a bit stolen with the previous comment, because I was going to comment sort of along those lines, but you know, we heard a lot of complaining from the Republicans in Annapolis when the Democrats rammed through the legislation that enables the Attorney General to sue the Trump administration. But I thought to myself, you know, this is probably exactly what Larry Hogan wants, because now he doesn't have to take a position. He's never going to be confronted with a situation where, you know, Annapolis is demanding that he take action and give an up or down vote to action on that Frost would want to engage in it. So now it's out of his hands. He can sort of throw his hands up and say, well, I tried, and it's not my problem anymore. And I think this is all part and parcel to what you all were just discussing, which is a strategy of avoiding overtly political discussions wherever possible. And I think this is a great outcome for Hogan.
That's an interesting point.
Well, that's
Jim.
The point that Brian Frosch made. The problem is when you look at the bill, the resolutions that were passed giving Frosch this power, the powers are very, very broad. It's not just about Trump policies. It's about anything that affects the health and welfare of Maryland. So it's a really fundamental change in the relationship between the Attorney General and the governor, and some would argue that it's appropriate. But
got a couple of I got a tweet and an email concerning paid sick leave. William tweets, I favor paid sick leave, but it should also include generous tax credits to offset the expense. Here's an email from Carol who says, please point out the difference between the legislature's paid sick leave bill and Governor Hogan's paid sick leave bill. It's not just companies with more than 15 employees, that's the legislature's bill, and companies with more than 50 employees, which is Hogan's bill. But she says that Hogan's bill specifies 50 employees at one location. So she asks, how many McDonald's have 50 employees at one location? How many bank branches? You know, it cuts the number of people covered from an estimated 700,000 to an estimated 200,000, which is a huge difference. So, Aaron, that is quite a substantial difference.
Right. And she points out a distinction between what Governor Hogan and his staff said his bill was going to do and then what the bill actually says that it's going to do. So they pitched it as something that would affect any company that had 50 more employees or more. But the text of the legislation that's under debate says exactly as your writer says, that it has to be 50 employees at a single location. So, I mean, as she points out, that a lot of these franchised, food businesses, I mean, 50 employees is a lot of workers for a small business. So if you're a small business and you spread your employees out at more than one site, then you could get around the requirement of having to offer any of them sick time. So she's correct. It does greatly diminish the number of people who could apply. I mean, when we talk about that in general terms, we kind of leave out that nuance because it, you know, makes the conversation a lot longer. And, you know, the big picture is 15 employees, but versus 50, but she's right. It's a lot more complicated than that.
Yeah, thank you for that insight, Carol, and Aaron as well. Rachel, we're running out of time here, but let me ask you a little bit about this proposal to make Maryland a so-called sanctuary state. I know that Catherine Pugh was on the program a couple of weeks ago. She ran like a deer away from the term sanctuary city. Where does it stand on the state level?
So it had a hearing last week, and there are a couple of different competing proposals. This particular bill would prevent local or state law enforcement and some other local and state entities from basically participating in immigration enforcement. So in other words, if federal immigration agents want someone's immigration status checked, if they have to do it themselves. They're not going to be able to get local and state police agencies holding people without warrants signed by judges and in order for them to run checks on people's immigration status. And they're not going to have people checking immigration status when they pull someone over in the car or something like that. And then, of course, you have opposing proposals that require local and state law enforcement agencies to assist federal immigration enforcement. So both of these are playing out. Both of these had hearings. We'll see where they go from here.
All right. Plenty of subjects we weren't able to get to today, but I very much appreciate all three of you coming in at a very busy time for you all and talking about this. We will check in with you again as the session continues. Thanks so much. Rachel Bay covers Annapolis for WYPR. Aaron Cox is the State House Bureau Chief of the Baltimore Sun. Len Lazarus is the editor and publisher of MarylandReporter.com. That'll do it for us today. Tomorrow, we take a look at a pretty radical suggestion from researchers at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health on how to deal with the growing problem of opioid addiction. They're proposing that we open two places in Baltimore, one on the east side and one on the west side, where people could come to inject drugs in a supervised environment. They're doing this in Canada and in Europe. We'll talk to the author of a new study commissioned by the ABLE Foundation and an expert in the treatment of addiction about creating so-called safe spaces for drug use. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. Thanks to The Diz for supplying lunch today for our guests. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. You can find them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. I'm Tom Hall. On behalf of the Midday team, thanks for listening. Have a great day.